Welcome back to the Inventing Podcast, where we dive into trending topics and issues in education that matter most to you. In this episode, Dr. Haynes talks with us about the first steps towards innovation in schooling and shares insights from his time in Finland. Enjoy!
I'm going to read some words today from my guest, Dr. Michael Haynes. He is the superintendent of schools at Port Washington School District and an associate professor of educational leadership at Long Island University. His book, Staying Grounded, 12 Principles for Transforming School Leader Effectiveness, is available on Amazon. He recently wrote an article for Newsday. This is an excerpt from it. It is our collective responsibility to foster a meaningful post-pandemic education environment. As the great philosopher John Dewey stated more than 100 years ago, if we teach today's students as we taught yesterday's, we rob them of tomorrow. Now is the time to revolutionize this antiquated system built on old structures and ideologies. Thank you, Dr. Haynes, for coming on with us today. Let's jump right in. Why is now the time to rethink things?
Well, thank you, David. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. And I don't think there's a better time to actually do something like this. I think many educators over time, when they transition to becoming a teacher, their world is their oyster, right? They're very excited. And I have found more often than not over the past 25 years in education, even though I don't look it, it's been 25 years. What I found is that flame really begins to diminish. It diminishes a lot quicker than we would like to believe for many reasons. And what I've seen from a policy standpoint, whether there are federal policies or state policies, it takes the autonomy, it takes the professionalism out of teachers. And now I believe teachers have the ability, and educators, not just teachers, have the ability to flip this switch and turn it into something that we've always wanted, which is really to make sure that we maximize the potential and talents of our kids the way that we see fit. Now we have all of our kids at home. And again, it's not just happening in the United States. It's internationally happening. I just had a conversation with Ken Robinson a couple of weeks ago, just talking about this same thing. You know, what's happening in England or what's happening in, let's say, France or Spain is really the same thing that's happening in Kansas in many ways, or in California or Oregon, where parents are home with their kids, teachers are home with their own children. They're designing these great lessons that they were never able to design before. And there's no reason whatsoever, I believe, to go back to the way it was. I think we certainly should keep some things, no doubt about it. But now is the best time when we are collectively home experiencing many of the same things and really figuring out what is the true purpose of education. I just don't think we really think about that. I think we go through the motions. We get to the end of the week, to the end of the month, the end of the year, and then we rinse and repeat, and we do it the same thing the following year. Now we can actually think about why are kids in school, and we know from a legal standpoint they have to be in school until a certain age, but what is it that we actually want when we have them for 14,000 hours or more while they're with us? Now we can actually clearly define that and make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's funny, this idea had come up a couple months ago. I'd interviewed the author of a book called Happy Teacher Habits. And some of, you know, what was in that book was about, you know, teachers really bringing themselves to the classroom, their passions, their interpretations of the content. And that in many ways, that lack of autonomy kind of does what you mentioned. It just kind of drives you down. You know, you kind of just get with the program and you're no longer shining through. You're no longer even enjoying your own subject.
That's right.
Right.
It's the ultimate sin, David. I mean, think about it, right? You have teachers who are so passionate about what they want to work with kids and engage them. And it takes a lot of energy to extinguish that flame. It really does. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah. And I think that this kind of leads into this next idea that I wanted to talk about. In the excerpt that I read, we talk about old structures and ideologies. We should be moving away in some direction. So can you just talk to us a little bit about where schooling is now, where we should be headed, Wherever you'd like to start that explanation, you know, where would be a good place to start talking about that?
Yeah, sure. I can start with my trip to Finland. And I'm not saying Finland is the end all and be all. I'm not at all. But I think one of the things that we do as educators is we become very trapped in our mental models of what we see in front of us. I call it horse blinders. You only see what's really either in front of you or what you've experienced. And I think it's so important to see and to learn from other school systems around the world. It's incredibly important because they do things in a much different way. And some ways it may be better, in some ways maybe not so. But when I was in Finland, for a prolonged period of time, speaking with not only the students, but with the teachers. And by the way, in Finland, they don't need superintendents in Finland. You know, the teachers really are the end all and be all. They are treated like doctors, like attorneys. I mean, just the top of the heap as far as not only pay, but certainly as far as professionalism. And what I learned were a few different things. One is when I talk about structures, the structures we have in place for the most part have been in place since the early 1900s or even earlier. Very little has changed as far as the way we batch kids. Kids go to first grade, then they go to second grade. It's all about, you know, by grade level. What I found very interesting in Finland is that the school day is shorter, the school year is shorter, and their focus is totally different. So the school day for an elementary school kid is typically about an hour and a half shorter. Then they have four different recess breaks within the day. However, by second grade, and by the way, this is a public system, right? So this isn't like an elite private school. What I found was, I'm spending the whole day in one school, and I'm seeing that we have 7 and 8 year olds taking multiple breaks throughout the days. And by second grade, they're speaking three different languages. And I'm like, well, how are they able to do that? They have homework, but it's not what gets them up in the morning, right? It's not the most important thing. The fact that kids are moving often and they're outside, there is a large degree of, the best way to put it is they want students to have self-directed learning opportunities, to have a locus of control, how important it is for them to control things that are happening in their lives. There is a large degree of trust, not only with kids being kids, meaning they can climb trees and not, you know, have 10 attorneys underneath ready to file lawsuits, you know what I mean? So, and then there's the hyper-focus on wellness, which is where I believe all of this needs to go. So when you ask the question of, you know, what does the future potentially look like? For me, it's very simple. It's a focus on wellness and whether that wellness has four different edges to it. You know, there's the physical wellness. There's an emotional wellness that's there. There's a cognitive wellness as far as clearly we want students to learn as much as they can, have these experiences. And we can talk about assessments in a little bit so we know how kids are faring. And then finally, the social aspect, which I think is missing right now, unfortunately, with this pandemic, that social construct, the human need to interact socially. All four of those things I felt were not only clearly on display within the schools, but then when I spoke to the person who's in charge of all of the systems in Finland, right? So the number one person who's in charge of the education system, I said, what are your two main focal points and what are you focused on for the next several years? Two different things. One was wellness. The second, and very clear. Second was teachers, making sure they were okay and they were engaged in what's happening from a policy perspective. And I was like, where am I? Like, this is really, really incredible. Nice and clear, nice and simple. When you look at their standards in Finland, and again, I'm not saying it's the end all and be all, but it's something to learn from. If I was to print out the standards for English language arts, for math, for science and social studies in New York State, it would take up my whole office and then some. In Finland, it was about this thick. And the question becomes, or it's the paradox is less is more, I think in some cases. And you are able to become more efficient and I believe ultimately more effective when it comes to designing, I would say, educational experiences for kids. So that to me, and I know I'm touching on a lot of different things. I learned a lot in a very short period of time of what can be, right? So that's one facet of it. And then, of course, there are wonderful schools all over, sprinkled throughout the United States, and we can learn those universal best practices. But I think we have the ability now, while the pause button is pressed, is for us to figure out collectively what is in the best interest of kids. And I don't know if we've done that for a long time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been taking notes as you've been talking, trying to keep up, really, so I could pull out a couple of major points and kind of dive into those. So, you know, I'm a principal. I'm hearing what you're saying right now. I hear part of what you've just described revolves around wellness, physical, emotional, cognitive, social. Hey, I've got an SEL program at my school. Is that enough, Dr. Hines? Is that enough? They're not all equal, right? But in general, the general concept of when a school thinks, I'm going to implement this SEL program at my school, is that enough? Or were there elements in what you saw in Finland that just that were affecting different parts of the schooling environment or different parts of the schooling experience that our SEL programs may not really touch? Can you?
Oh yeah, sure. No, definitely. Is it enough? No. Is it a start? 100%. Because I think if we look at it from a visual standpoint, here in the States, and I can't certainly speak to your school in particular, and I would say I'm hyper-generalizing when I say this, if there was an oval and in the middle of that oval is test scores or graduation rate, whatever is the main focal point for a school and or for a school district, it's usually related, you know, to tests and scores and rankings of where they stand compared to other places. In Finland, it's not. There's no competition. It's wellness. And so everything starts and begins with that. And I can't necessarily say that's so where we are. Now, if the hyper-focus is on cognitive ability and making sure that students maximize their inquiry methods and talents in that way, that's at the focal point. Then you'll have those spokes coming out of that wheel, so to speak. And SEL will be one of them, but it's not the major focal point. I think it's the inverse, where, you know, it's the opposite of in Finland. And the results, I think, are pretty powerful. Now, can we do that everywhere? I don't think we can, and I don't think we should. Can you scale that up? I'm not really sure. But it certainly can be more of a priority. And I think it's like, how do you find a balance? You know, how do you find a balance with all of this and not go to the extremes? And I think we can, because, and then I'll be quiet. The pendulum has swung so far in this direction, right? I think we don't have to swing it all the way back in this direction, but we could find a middle ground here. And I think this time during this pandemic is the best way for us to be a big chiropractor, to adjust everything, and to find something in the middle that suits the needs of all of our kids.
I'm giving this more thought. I'm thinking that you're right. There are many reasons why that you gave that now is a great time to kind of reset, but also because what you're suggesting is we need to take a closer look at wellness. But aren't we all doing that right now because of the virus anyway? I mean, it's on our minds. Health and wellness, mental health has come up. I mean, it's already a part of what we are doing every single day, not only as teachers, but just as people, as we're going to the grocery store. Now, of course, we're trying not to catch a virus, right? So it's not exactly the same. But my point is just that that has been brought to the forefront. Wellness has been really brought to the forefront now, and I want to just make a comment about, you know, where do you start? And I think I love design thinking, right? I love this idea of building like systems framework based off of just sort of an overarching goal. And I think it's not a stretch to say, hey, let's look at our school, let's look at our district, and try to identify issues and understand how they may relate to wellness and try to build out solutions that are kind of just more aligned to wellness. It could just be one thing. It could just be the drop-off line, right? I mean, because if you're spending an hour in a drop-off line, that's not going to promote good mental health, right? Because I want to get out of there, right? I want to get my kid and get out of there. So just these little areas, we might be just to apply a problem-solving approach with this sort of big idea of contributing to the overall wellness, and it's going to take some time.
Oh, it definitely is. And you use some really great examples as to how we can do that. And I think part of the issue moving forward is, you know, the pandemic is terrible, right? But the fact that it's lasting as long as it is, I think makes it less likely for us to go back to the way things were before. If this lasted like a weekend or a week, we're definitely more inclined to go back to homeostasis and back to the way things were. You know, I always say, you know, being homeostatic, it's like being in a lukewarm bathtub and you don't want to get out, right? So in this instance, though, we're not. We are very uncomfortable and we are learning along the way, and it's longitudinal. So now the way that we are thinking long term is starting to adjust. And that's why I also think it's a prime time to think about what we want. And it all means nothing unless we clearly define, and I say we, the collective we, whether it's in a school district or in the state that you reside in, the real purpose of school. Because I guarantee you, you know, in New York State, we have over 750 school districts. But if I was to ask, let's say all superintendents, all 750 of them, or the boards, you know, the board president, what the purpose of school is, we'll have 750 different answers. And that is part of the problem. We need a universal, just a common understanding of what it is, and then to move forward with that universal thought and design, as you just said, what our systems can and should look like. And they should look different than the way they are right now.
I'm sure if you asked the same question to a graduating class of educators coming out of college, what the purpose of schooling is, they'd have that many different answers. I mean, I did my master's degree in math education, essentially, right? And, you know, going through courses in philosophy of education. And I mean, you leave with a sense, right? But you don't leave with a clear purpose, right? You leave with the ability to think about what a purpose of education means, right? But you don't leave with a clear focus. One thing I want to ask you about the purpose of education, but I made a note earlier that I'm still interested in. You said you were comparing the let's say language arts standards between New York State and what you saw in Finland. And so if they're that much shorter in length, what was missing from that that you think? I mean, if you may not have studied it that in that great of depth, or maybe you did, but I'm just wondering, if it's that much less, what's missing from that that is contributing to, you know, more teacher autonomy, wellness? Yeah,
sure. Well, I think you just nailed it. The thing is, they trust the local, and they trust the local schools and the teachers in designing what they want. So ultimately, it's like by the end of third grade, here are 7 or 8 exit outcomes, right? These are the non-negotiable things that we want students to be able to be proficient and or, you know, have proficiency or mastery in. They are not going to, with 75,000 bullets, it's going to be this, it's going to be this, there's going to be a subset of this and then this, and it has to happen in October as opposed to May. It is, this is what it looks like. We trust your judgment. We value you as a professional that you will get it done. And that is the biggest difference. And so the expectations are still very high, but they are not micromanaging every single little thing that takes place in the classroom. And on top of that, they are not testing kids into oblivion, meaning that, and they're not basing any test scores on a teacher performance. Now, whether we agree or disagree, I'm not saying you and I, but say universally that this is the way we should go. How do we hold teachers accountable? I will say this, in Finland, parents hold them accountable because they have such high standards for their teachers. And the teaching institutions and the universities there, they're taught like NASA astronauts over there. Their programs are so comprehensive and very difficult to get into. And you don't have to be the smartest person in the room, but you have to have certainly different capabilities as far as making sure you can be a teacher in a school that we will hold you in such high regard. But back to the programming per se, you know, as far as what it looks like from standards, the trust in teachers is, I've never seen anything like it in my life.
Yeah, you said a couple things that I want to just quickly comment on. First of all, this micromanaging of even just content. The other day, I saw something on Facebook. I won't divulge, you know, who the poster was, but it said, "Do you know that there are 1,127 skills in math?" That was the comment, and I thought, okay, I have a math degree, and I would have to say that is quite a a very proud statement to think that you know how many skills are required in mathematics. I mean, we're talking K-12 mathematics, we're talking college level math, we're talking graduate school mathematics, and because I have made mathematical discoveries by doodling. Is doodling one of your skills? Why do we have to control everything to the minutia, right? I think that, you know, that grabbing of power of knowledge is just it's a killer to creativity.
Oh,
right.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, because if I'm not learning your skills, then I can't. Then I must not understand mathematics or something like that, right? I mean, yes, if we want to say, hey, to meet these objectives, there are this many skills we're saying are related to it. Okay, but to make a statement about math in general, okay, yeah. I'm of the belief that, you know, we haven't been around as a race long enough to make any, you know, completely objective statements about mathematics to start, okay? The second thing is that you said something, and I want to know if you agree with me, because I wrote it down as a quick insight. You said that, you know, parents hold teachers accountable. Earlier you said that teachers are held in very high esteem. They're held like as doctors. The other place that I have seen this sort of reverence for teachers was when I studied Japanese lesson study. Right. And so what I'm wondering now, because you said, how do we hold teachers accountable then? And so I'm wondering if by holding this reverence and creating this status, if that alone creates sort of an implied accountability. Because you look, when you're a doctor, you're not going to do anything that's going to take that away from you, right? Do you think there's something there just that we raise them up, then they'll automatically understand, like, I have to do this right. I've got to do this well.
100%. I mean, that's it in a nutshell. I couldn't have said it any better. That's exactly what it is. And so if the parents are not holding someone accountable, the other teachers are holding their peers and their colleagues accountable. You know, there's a collective wanting to be the best that you can be. And if someone is falling a little bit short for whatever reason, because things happen in life, right, they're there to assist and to help to make sure that, you know, everyone is doing what they're supposed to be doing. I just think from a humanistic standpoint and from an operational standpoint, there is no other way. And so the punishment method, the micromanaging, the big brother method, clearly does not work. Yet we have a love affair here with it here in the States. And we think there's no other way. You know, there's I think a general sense of, you know, we want people only do what's inspected instead of what's expected, right? I don't think that's necessarily true. I really don't. I work best when people aren't breathing down my back, but that's just me. And I'd like to think most people are, because they want to do the best they can do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I like that comment you made, it took me a while to understand it. People only do what's expected, not what's inspected. Was that the gist of it?
Yeah. So, you know, I think the thought process here, and I'm talking administratively, and again, I'm hyper generalizing. There's the mindset of, you know, teachers will only do things if we inspect them all the time, instead of just saying, here's what we expect, and then you rise to that level of expectation through support. You know, when someone asks me what my job is, right? My job is very simple. My job is, if I'm speaking to a teacher, is to make sure you get everything that you need and deserve, so our children get everything they need and deserve. And what does that look like? What does that sound like? Like, I am a conduit to make sure I am supporting you and to guide you if you need certain things. Or if I'm finding out that things that are happening that shouldn't happen, to make sure to work with you to make sure they don't happen again. I am not here to be, you know, the whip snapper and the you know, walking around with a clipboard and saying, you need to do this 100 times a day. Nobody, I don't care who they are. Maybe for the short term, someone can work in those, you know, types of expectations. But generally, especially when we're working with kids, it's a recipe for disaster. So, you know, back to the original point of why can't we learn from other places, not only in the States, but to the north of us in Canada, who do very well, I mean, incredibly well with so many different things, so many innovative ideas. And look to Europe and to, you know, all the other countries that are out there. And I just don't think we do enough of that.
So I want to start to focus a little bit more on this, on wellness, basically. You mentioned not that long ago that you kind of feel like this first focus on wellness and sort of deriving after that, you know, how it affects the curriculum, how it affects, you know, our learning communities, how it affects the community. But we're starting with this idea of wellness. What are some ways that you have seen schools make well-being a top priority? And what are some ways that we can do it? You know, how can we think about that?
So not many public schools, but that doesn't mean they aren't out there. I don't see many of them doing it just because of the constraints that are there, the mandates that are there. You know, the hyper-focus on, you know, test scores and the hyper-focus on, you know, where schools are ranking compared to others. Sometimes it's very difficult to make that switch. I will say, when I was in my previous school district, one of the big philosophical shifts, we called it PEAS, P-E-A-S, which is physical, emotional, academic, and social growth. It was a balancing and a blending and a synergistic way of looking at what a whole child experience looks like. So I guess what we did, not that I guess, I know we did because I worked with our staff to make this happen, is the first thing we did was double recess from 20 minutes to 40 minutes. And that in by itself, you would have thought like, you know, like the world crumbled. Right? 40 minutes of recess. Why would kids need 40 minutes of recess? Well, I'm like, well, if federal prisoners are mandated to have at least 1 hour of recess, why can't children have 40 minutes of recess? So where the average in New York State was between 15 and 17 minutes, we went to 40 minutes, and they had 40 minutes of lunch on top of that for the socialization aspect. So they had an 80-minute block to be who they are. Right? Because now our kids, from the moment they wake up until the moment they go to bed, are told what to do in every which way, what to wear, what time to be somewhere, what they have to do as far as this, sports after school, make sure they do this when they're in the sports. We tell them what to do 24/7. They don't have the ability to think for themselves. And so we need to design pockets of time in the school day that allows them to have some self-directedness, whether it's they choose to play this or they choose to go in this direction. 80 minutes is a nice amount of time to start with. And that's the first thing we did. We also incorporated yoga and mindfulness. That was part of all of our students. They got exposed to it. And when I say exposed to it, you know, it wasn't just for like 5 minutes or like the one-shot deal. Somebody comes in for the year, they do it once and then they leave. No, it was built in systemically for that to take place because we felt that inner journey is just as important as any outward journey they are going to take. So we had mindfulness rooms, we had yoga mats for kids, and it allowed them again to explore what's taking place on the inside, to learn how to recalibrate if and when, I call them these emotional solar flares, like the sun, you'll see these solar flares. When we have a solar flare emotionally, we need to teach our kids how to recalibrate and bring them back so we don't have to suspend them and they have to go home and then they don't learn anything, right? So all of these different things were tied to a wellness factor. And then, to be honest with you, from a professional development standpoint, we had to reintroduce theorists that we all know about as educators, right? Maslow it's not just basic needs being met at the bottom or the base of the pyramid, is how do we have kids self-actualize? Like ultimately, in the end, if we can, as a human race, self-actualize to be the best that we can be, that's the ultimate gift. And so if you're asking me what the purpose of education is, it's to get us as close to self-actualizing, to know what our talents are, what our potential is, and how we can contribute to society. If we can do that after 13 or 14 years, right, over 14,000 hours, we have done a great job. But we don't need these old systems in place in order to make that happen. And if we focus on wellness with some of those few things that I just shared, I think we are getting just a little bit closer to doing so.
Yeah. You brought up a lot of great points, and a few really hit close to home, because I think after this episode of the podcast, by the way, I've interviewed a professor out of Texas State University, and he's a Freirean scholar. And we talked, Paulo Freire, right? And, you know, thinking about that philosopher's works, Pedagogy of Freedom, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, a lot of what you're saying is it lines up with that kind of thinking, that we need to create circumstances and environments to help these kids discover who they are, and not impose on them who we are, or impose on them what we think they should do and how we think they should think.
Right.
We can hand over knowledge, but they need to have an opinion about that knowledge, right? And to take it a step further, and I'm bringing in that other conversation, I'm bringing in Freire in general, and I'm also just validating what you've said, is that it's more than just a suggestion. It's our duty. I mean, if we are just manufacturing students, manufacturing people, how is that ethical? This person, this little person, is unique in the world. If we don't allow them to understand how they're unique, then how on earth do we expect them to uniquely contribute to society, right? Uniquely contribute to our democracy.
That's right.
And things like, and you've gave some really clear examples, right? That we need to think of alternatives to high stakes testing. That we need to, you said double recess, but really that's more free time. It doesn't have to be recess, right? It's just, hey, let the kid be for a while.
That's right.
Let him be human for an hour, right? Instead of you know, being told what to do all day. So I think that you know, this is a very timely conversation, and very, very, very timely, because you could have a similar conversation about teachers, couldn't you? Right.
Sure,
I mean, let them be for a while, right? Let them. Let them say, you know, man, I remember when I first learned this content, I found this awesome example and it affected me this way. Share that with your class.
Yeah.
Right?
It's so true. Yeah. I mean, right? It's really a great point. The same things we would want for the students that we're serving really should be the same things for teachers. And to be honest with you, take it a step further, even for our principals. Mm. You know, so we don't need to be breathing down everybody's neck. We really should be looking at ways to support, and to really, you know, think of different ways of, I don't know, just moving forward. A lot of what we're talking about, it's just not rocket science. It's really not. What we're saying is not so outlandish. I think for most people who will listen to this will say, yeah, that makes sense. Yet, for one reason or another, to have most of the things that we're talking about come into play within our schools, it's almost impossible. And you have to break down so many walls just to get something that sounds so fundamentally just appropriate. It's really crazy.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm looking at the time. We have time. We're not running out of time by any means. I want to talk a little bit about assessments. And so in reading your article, I just want to quickly quote, just to lead us into this next direction. You mentioned upgrade testing and other assessments. Stop the standardized testing of children in grades 3 through 8. Opt up to higher quality assessments by classroom teachers. And that really struck me. I was wondering about some examples of higher quality testing. How do you envision that?
Sure. Boy, yeah, I could talk about this all day. So let me start with something that's, it'll sound like it's unrelated, but it really is. All right. So part of, I think, of the focus or the lack thereof with when our kids exit our system, you know, there's such a strong push for our kids to go to the universities, right? To go to college. And if they don't go to college, they're perceived as less than, and schools didn't do a good job, right? So if they don't go to college, 2-year, 4-year, whatever it is, schools really didn't do their job. And I don't know when that narrative really changed, but it changed, and it's been changed for quite some time, certainly from the 80s and 70s. Part of what I believe our students need, and from a system standpoint, is a refocus on CTE education, right? So career and technical education. For students who want to go into the trades, who want to become entrepreneurs, who want to use their hands in all these different ways, and yet don't have to go to a college and or university. When you assess kids who use their hands and use their minds in different ways, I don't think their talents are going to show up on a convergent type of test where they're looking at an A, B, C, or D, right? So we have this love affair with convergent thinking, and we don't do enough of divergent thinking, I don't think, within our schools and or from assessments. Now, in some content areas, clearly, you can be a lot more flexible. But for one reason or another, when we look at state assessments, for the most part, it is convergent thinking. One problem, one solution only, as opposed to divergent thinking, one problem, multiple ways to attack it. And so I always go back to this thing that Ken Robinson brought up in one of his TED Talks in this book, Breakpoint and Beyond. And it's in that particular book, I think it was written in the mid 90s, there's a longitudinal study in there, and it talked about these kindergartners, right? Thousands of kindergartners who were tested for their divergent thinking skills. And please stop me if you heard this study. It's really amazing. I think it's around 1,500 kindergartners, something like that. They took multiple assessments to find out, you know, how well they did on with divergent thinking. And 98% of them scored at the genius level. 98% scored at the genius level, 4- and 5-year-olds. Same group, same cohort, 5 years later, tested again. Now, if I was to ask most people, do you think it went to 100%? The answer is not even close, right? It went down to 32-33%. Hmm. 5 years later, this is the best part, right? 5 years later, same group of kids, divergent thinking skills. Now, for some would say divergent thinking is one of the cornerstones for creativity. It's one of the seeds for creativity for that type of thinking, right? Went down to 9%. 9%. So you could make this, you know, you could surmise and go, wow, well, what the heck happened? You know, kids are clearly getting dumber, you know, as they get older when it comes to divergent thinking. And or you can say, what is the system not doing enough of to provide those types of opportunities? I think it's that. But here's the kicker. Then they actually assess 22-year-olds for their divergent thinking skills, and less than 2% scored at the genius level. So let's think about what we can do from an assessment standpoint and to refocus maybe a little bit more on what that means, what does it look like? And so if we're asking about assessments, again, this hyper-focus on assessments that look at, you know, an A, B, C, or D answer, we need to move away from that, not completely, but we definitely need to move that pendulum away from it. And let's look at problem-based learning types of opportunities for kids and ways we can assess them. Not only problem-based learning, but project-based learning types of opportunities where they have the ability to showcase the way they orally communicate, the way they work with on teams, right? All these different things that are so important in the workspace when they move forward, if and when they choose to go to college, you need the ability to speak well. You need the ability to work well, to be empathetic. All of those things we need to start focusing on. And that is where the assessment shift, I believe, needs to take place. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it answers it comprehensively. And I was thinking about my own son as you were talking. He's 4 years old, And if there was a divergent thinker,
that's right.
I mean, every, you know, an experiment with this, an experiment with that, he's got great ideas. You know, he told me the other day that, you know, why don't we just put something in our skin to kill the virus? And I'm like, you know what? That's the beginning of a cure right there. No, right? And he's thinking about it.
That's right.
You know, he's thinking about it, and he's using whatever it is he knows, whatever logic he has to try to come up with a solution. And what does this mean our school systems are doing to kids? I mean, that's really, I mean, just driving the creativity out of them.
Listen, in my estimation, I think we do a very good job of doing that. And like we extinguish the flames of many teachers and educators, we certainly do a very good job of doing the same thing, I believe, with our kids, unless we make a massive change and shift. And this is the time to do it.
No, I agree. And we're doing the same thing to teachers as we are to students, driving that creativity out of them because of so much, you know, this granular oversight over everything that's happening, right? And we talked a little bit about that as well. I want to give you a moment to because I have not read your book, Staying Grounded, but I'd like to hear maybe a summary of that, or if you want to share with us a little bit of what that book is about. Does it include some of the things that we've been talking about today?
It does. It touches upon a few of the things. I mean, you know, the book was written, so I think back to when I became a teacher back in the mid-90s, Harry Wong's book, The First 100 Days of School, right? That was, I still have it, which is actually pretty pathetic. I still have it. It was a book, a resource for me that it just helped me in so many ways. I actually get goosebumps even thinking about it. I love that book. As when I became an administrator, gosh, I don't know, 16 years ago, 17 years ago, there was nothing like that for me. Or I don't think, either that or I just didn't find it. And I find it now that I still don't see a book out there that allows someone from a very practical standpoint to lead themselves and then to lead others. So that book was written for, I believe, an aspiring administrator, someone who's maybe, you know, been at it for 5 years, and or the grizzly veteran who's been around a while who wants to maybe learn a thing or two. And so I divided it into 12 very simple principles, you know, I believe, to make us more effective as leaders. And it's broken up into three different parts: the inner journey that we all, I believe, have to take, the outer journey that we have to take, and then the future of what we should be focusing on. And so that's really the premise of the book. I wrote it in conversational style. So it's like, you know, I'm sitting here in my office with somebody having a cup of coffee. That's the way I wanted it to come out. I didn't want 75,000 citations and, you know, this was gleaned from, you know, this research study. It's very practical. I'd like to think it's useful.
Yeah, excellent. I love that first category, inner journey. And we've been talking about that the whole time. How do we empower all of these stakeholders in this child's educative experience to allow them to have an inner journey, discover about them, discover themselves, mm-hmm. discover their own creativity? Maybe only then we can move on to that external journey and then on to the future. Well, I'll remain optimistic, Dr. Hines, and I really appreciate you coming on with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, David. It's really a pleasure, and best of luck to you and everything that you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Edmentum Podcast. Let us know your thoughts by sharing with us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram. Follow us on SoundCloud and stay tuned for upcoming episodes.